This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, want to get in shape in the new year? Maybe your fitness tracker can help you out, but maybe not as much as you'd like. Coming up, we'll talk about the pros and cons of fitness tracking devices and how to make the most of them. Now, diabetes is one of the most common chronic illnesses in the U.S. About 1 in 10 Americans have the disease. That number has grown in the last 2 years. But insulin, a key treatment, isn't getting any more affordable. The price of insulin increased 1,000% between 1999 and 2019 to over $300 per vial. In other developed countries, the price of insulin has stayed about the same. Here's President Biden talking about the issue of insulin affordability.
What do you do if you're a mom and a dad working with minimum wage, busting your neck? You look at your kid, and you know if you don't get that vaccine for him, if you don't get that drug for him, what happens? You're likely to go into a coma, maybe die. You strip away all the dignity of a parent looking at their child. I'm not joking about this. Imagine being a parent looking at a child and you can't afford. You have no house to borrow against. You have no savings. It's wrong.
We're talking about why insulin is so expensive in the U.S. and why the country's an outlier on the issue. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or someone close to you diabetic? Have you had trouble affording insulin or other treatments? You could share your experience now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar is a professor at the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine and the editor of Nature's Blood Cancer Journal. He's the author of a research paper titled "The High Cost of Insulin in the United States: An Urgent Call to Action." Dr. Rajkumar, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote this paper looking at why insulin is so much more expensive in the U.S. compared to peer nations around the world. First of all, can you tell us how expensive it's gotten over not that long a period of time?
Yeah, as you commented, you know, insulin, the analog insulins have been around since the late 90s, early 2000s till now, and introduced at prices of like $20, $25, and now close to $300 or more. So that's a dramatic increase in price for the exact same product without any modifications over these years. So it's quite baffling.
And you write in this paper, this is a life or death issue for many people with diabetes. And you share the story of a man named Alex Smith in particular. Can you tell us his story?
Yes, sure. I mean, I'm a cancer doctor and I was worried about cancer drug prices until I heard about Alex Smith's story. Alex was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and there are 1.3 million Americans with type 1 diabetes, where if you don't have insulin, you die. And he was on insulin, and at age 26, you know, you go off your own, off your parents' insurance onto your own. And that's June 1st of 2017, he was on his own. The insurance available to him when he tried to purchase it came with a $7,600 deductible and a monthly premium of $440. And he couldn't afford this. So he thought he'll just buy insulin with cash. And unfortunately, the price of insulin was out of his affordable range. As I mentioned, it costs over $300 a vial. So sadly, within 27 days, he died in this developed country due to rationing insulin. So this really struck me, and I went into the details of why insulin is so heavily priced. It's a 100-year-old drug. Of course, improvements have been made, but none major since about 2000.
We are talking to Dr. Vincent Rajkumar with the Mayo Clinic, looking at the high cost of insulin. We'll talk about some of the things that are leading to those high costs in a few minutes. Now, I want to take a moment to talk to someone who's personally experienced how difficult it can be to get affordable insulin and other important parts of treatment. Bram Sable-Smith is a reporter for Kaiser Health News, formerly with Wisconsin Watch. He also has type 1 diabetes. When he relocated to a new city, he wrote about his experience trying to get insulin in between doctors. Bram, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, you report on issues like this, of course. In this case, though, it was happening to you. You moved and you entered into this, I don't know, Kafka-esque nightmare of trying to get treatment and get your insurance to pay for it. Can you share a little of what you ran into?
Yeah, so I relocated for this job to St. Louis. So I moved from Wisconsin to St. Louis. And I had to actually cancel my appointment with my diabetes doctor in Wisconsin right before I moved. Because, you know, I couldn't go because of the move, because of the logistics of that. And when I came to St. Louis, I tried to set up an appointment with a diabetes doctor here that was in network for my new insurance. And they couldn't get me in until December 23rd. So then when I was trying to refill my prescription of insulin at the pharmacy, they were getting a message that my insurance was not going to cover my insulin cost because I needed a new prescription and then something called a prior authorization from my doctor. And they didn't have one on file for my new insulin prescription from a new doctor. And so my insurance was refusing to cover it. And so, you know, I was going to be on the hook, Rob. I needed 2 vials of insulin a month. Without insurance coverage, I was on the hook for $678 is what the price was going to be for just those 2 vials. And this is these are 2 vials of Humalog, which is a insulin made by Eli Lilly that came on the market in 1996 for, you know, $21 a vial or so. So I was really up against it. And it was you said Kafka-esque. It really was a nightmare. It took me 16 phone calls, several hours on the phone. This is during the work days, just to get my prescription.
And now you got a taste of what life without insurance can cost someone with diabetes. And the insulin itself, that cost, you mentioned the $600 plus a month, that's just part of the story, right? There's a lot of other stuff that goes into it.
That's right. So, I mean, there's also some, I've written in the past about continuous glucose monitors. These are a really, really useful tool. So, you know, insulin, diabetics use insulin to lower our blood sugars, but you also have to monitor your blood sugar, right? To know how much insulin you need, to know how to correct yourself. And so normally what people are doing is they're sticking their fingers, drawing a little bit of blood, putting that blood on a test strip that goes into a machine and you get a reading. And doctors recommend you do this 4 to 10 times a day. So you have a good sense of what your blood sugar is to see how you're managing it. Well, with a continuous glucose monitor, like the one I use, it just stays in your arm for 10 days, and it gives you very accurate readings of your blood sugar every 5 minutes, right? So this is like almost 300 times per day you're getting readings just automatically right to your smartphone. They're incredible. Because of this thing, I've lowered my blood sugar dramatically because of tools like this. But they are expensive. I was looking, Rob, you can get discount continuous glucose monitors at Costco. So one component is $200. You need that one. Another component is $300, and that would last you about a month. So that's $300 every month. Another component is $150, and that lasts you for 3 months. So you're just continually going to be spending that much money month after month after month after month if you don't have the insurance coverage. And that price puts these kind of things out of reach for a whole lot of Americans.
Bram, before I let you go, you're a reporter. Part of your job is to track down complicated things, research things on the internet, be persistent in calling people. You are custom built to try to navigate this stuff, and it was still a nightmare for you. What's it like for people who, you know, maybe they're not as familiar with technology, English as a second language, whatever other barriers they might run into trying to navigate this system?
Or they just simply don't have the time during the workday.
Sure.
I mean, it can be impossible and dangerous and deadly. I mean, this is one of the things that's really salient about insulin prices is that for type 1 diabetics like me, it's not an exaggeration. If you don't have insulin, you die. If you don't have insulin, your blood literally becomes so acidic that it starts eating away your organs from the inside. It's brutal. And so if people don't have the time, don't know how to advocate for themselves, aren't able to make those 16 phone calls, then they're on the hook for these enormous prices. And sadly, that can be tragic sometimes for people. Alex Smith is the big example. I mean, his story has become so powerful and has become so talked about that Amy Klobuchar, when she announced her presidential campaign in 2020, was with Alex Smith's mother She was right there when she announced her presidential campaign. So that was a presidential campaign based on this story of how difficult it's become to access insulin, to access prescription drugs for some people in this country.
Bram, thanks again for joining us.
Always happy to.
That's Bram Sable-Smith with Kaiser Health News, talking about his personal experience not being able to find affordable insulin and some of his reporting. Let's go back now to Dr. Vincent Rajkumar from Mayo Clinic. Let's get into that enormous cost Bram mentioned. 100-year-old medication, in effect, the oldest version of insulin. What has driven this cost up so rapidly, Dr. Rajkumar?
You know, it's multiple factors. As I'm listening to Bram, I'm just like struck by, you know, the injustice of all of this, because first of all, people should realize insulin-dependent diabetics do nothing wrong. This is just an autoimmune type disease that just happens. It can happen to anyone. It can happen to anyone's child. And there is a treatment for it, which is 100% safe and effective. And so we should just make sure that it's affordable and accessible to everyone. In addition to the 1.3 million people with insulin-dependent diabetic, we have another 6-7 million people who have non-insulin-dependent or type 2 diabetes who also need the same drug. So we're talking about millions of people. So what's causing this? Number one, I think, is, as you heard from him, we have a vulnerable population. This population will pay anything to have access to the drug. And that sets the stage because it's not a choice for them. It's not a luxury option. Number two, we have a monopoly, a virtual monopoly, because only three companies control most of the insulin market. And they don't have to collude with prices, but they implicitly, like basically one person raises the price, the other company follows suit. And this has been going on for two decades now. It's lockstep and barrel. Like every time one company increases the price, the other increases because it's beneficial to both. So this virtual monopoly does not help. And anytime you have a monopoly, you need to have some price control to protect the public. And that's what we lack. We don't have the ability to negotiate for insulin prices. And so what happens is the companies can increase the price anytime they want with no reason. And that's been going on. And that's why what was $21 can become $300 without any improvement.
Talking to Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, professor at the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. He's telling us why insulin, medicine invented 100 years ago, is so expensive now in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a price cap on insulin? If you're dealing with diabetes, someone in your family, has your experience changed the way you view the American healthcare system? What do you want people to understand about having a chronic illness and being able to afford care? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, professor at the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine, about insulin affordability. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Howdy. Thanks for taking my call. I've had type 1 diabetes for 45 years. I have fought the healthcare system on a multitude of different things, so I understand this is not a premium healthcare system in the States. But on the insulin standpoint, yeah, it's nuts. I real quick, when I was traveling in Germany a few years ago, I had a vial. It dropped on the on a tile floor and shattered. I went to the emergency room. I was in Hanover, waited 5-10 minutes. They came out with a Humalog, Novolog, or the Humalog, $20.
$20.
And now it's $300 over the counter here. It's insane.
Bill.
Go ahead.
No, I just want to say thank you for sharing that experience. Apart from, you're dealing with this chronic illness, how draining is it for you to have to contend, as you said, fight the healthcare system to try to get this stuff affordably for all these years?
Oh, it's just a nightmare, and it depends on the insurance company. I just got on Medicare last year. $13,000 in a multitude of things. They just tripled my insulin copay. It's Quartz Medicare Advantage tripled from $15 a vial to $45 a vial for me. On top of everything else, Medicare, with all my diabetic supplies and everything, it's just nuts, and I can't get it. Some of the Medicare supplementals don't even cover insulin. They won't even offer it under their supplemental plans in Medicare.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. Dr. Rajkumar, first of all, that Germany story, what is Europe doing that keeps it at $20 a vial instead of $300 a vial?
So many things. I mean, the laws here prevent negotiation for price, and also there's no limit on how much prices can go up. In most of the countries, there's, first of all, more competition, and there are regulations where companies cannot increase the price, you know, without any valid reason. So, and most of these countries in Europe also have, you know, nationalized healthcare system where the government pays for the healthcare. So they are going to make sure that they are getting the good deal from the companies. It's just, don't have to go to Germany, just go north of the border to Canada. It's the same thing. I mean, people can go across the border and buy the same insulin that they get here at a fraction of the price. So it's something that we need to resolve rather quickly. And I think I have pointed this out many times. Insulin is like the Achilles heel of the pharmaceutical industry because there's no rationale for why the price would be going up for the same product. There's no innovation here. This is something that they've always talked about for other drugs. But if you solve the insulin problem, you actually can solve prescription drug problem for all other prescription drugs also.
Thanks again for that call. I think I know the answer here, Dr. Rajkumar. If insulin's for sale for $20 or whatever in Canada, can I call from Wisconsin and order some from here, or is that not allowed?
See, technically, importation of drugs is not legal, but in the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, they specifically wrote that the secretary does not have to enforce the laws if you bring back, say, if you go to Canada and bring back two or three vials. I'm not suggesting you do that, but I'm just saying that the Congress recognized this problem, and they were basically saying that if someone were to go to Canada and bring for personal use a small amount of supply, that's allowed. But I don't think that is a good solution. Canada doesn't have enough insulin to help America. So we need to come up with our own solution.
We were talking about high insulin prices for people with diabetes. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar stays with us from the Mayo Clinic, Alex School of Medicine. Back to your calls now. Teresa is with us in Land O'Lakes. Teresa, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Teresa?
So I am just speaking into the fact, I'm a health care provider. I'm a nurse practitioner. I also have type 1 diabetes. I've had it for 20 plus years. And one thing that's really alarming to me as a provider is that not only the cost of insulin, but also the cost of technology. And really that we're not offering this technology to people from different ethnic backgrounds. Because we think we have these preconceived notions that they can't afford it or they don't understand it, or even elderly populations. You know, things like insulin pumps have come a long way. Insulin pumps have come a long way to really helping people manage their diabetes. And we often don't advocate for these solutions in patient populations, unfortunately.
Teresa, thanks for the call, sharing your experience as someone with type 1 diabetes and in the healthcare system. Dr. Rajkumar, are we writing off some of our patients because we don't think they can deal with this technology or just assume they can't afford it?
Yeah, what Teresa says is so valid because, you know, it's like penny wise, pound foolish. Diabetes is a chronic illness. If you manage it well now, you save a lot on healthcare costs down the road because it causes heart disease and whatnot. So trying not to give people the best treatments now is not going to help us because we will spend more later. Plus, this is an illness that for insulin-dependent diabetics and many others is not something that is in their control, and we have good solutions, and so that's the other reason. And thirdly, people don't realize, like she mentioned, that it's not only the cost of insulin, it's all of these other products that go along with diabetes care that adds to the expense. And finally, even if you're on insurance or Medicare, the cost is not just the $35 copay. There's the deductible, which in Medicare Part D is now like $500 almost, that you have to meet before you will even get benefit from the insurance. And then at that point, you get a coinsurance of like, 20%, 25% that you have to pay. So it all adds up, and there's more cost than people realize.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Dan now in Madison. Dan, hi.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Dan?
Oh, man. I was diagnosed in 1991 as a type 1 brittle diabetic. So I've been an insulin dependent for 31 years of my life now. Ever since I was young, I was under my parents' medical coverage. So I had the health care plans and everything that covered my insulin and my testing supplies and everything else. And when I got 18 and moved away to college, I had to get my own insurance. And for a while, things were fairly decent. As of recently, I was in the union in Madison, and our health coverage was excellent. And my copay was next to nothing. Recently, I was laid off, and the cost of
We're losing your connection, Dan. Is there emergency help, Dr. Rajkumar, for somebody who, like Dan, sounds like he was laid off? Any emergency help for somebody in that situation suddenly needing to pay the full cost?
So I don't know about the situation in Wisconsin, but in Minnesota there is. I think right now there is a law, I think, passed in honor of Alex Smith that ensures that people who need insulin in an emergency can get it at an affordable price.
Dan, good luck to you. Just in our last few moments, Dr. Rajkumar, at least is the system taking this problem seriously now, do you think?
I think so. Hopefully something will happen. I don't want to get into legislation, sure. But certainly we need to find a way to cap the prices on insulin so that it's affordable. Secondly, we need to make sure that the other supplies that people talked about that people need to manage insulin-dependent diabetes or type 2 diabetes is available at reasonable prices.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Vincent Rajkumar from the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine, with us today to look at the high cost of insulin and possible solutions. You can keep sharing your stories and thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Some good news. As of this last weekend, copyrights expired on a number of books, movies, and recordings, meaning we all have free and unfettered access to the hottest culture of 1926. New Year's Day is also Public Domain Day, meaning that copyrights end on products of a certain age. That age has gotten longer over the years as laws let copyright holders keep their copyrights for longer and longer. So what is free to use starting now? Winnie the Pooh, for starters, the book, that is, Disney still holds the rights to the animated versions. Also on the free bookshelf, The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, along with works by Agatha Christie, Langston Hughes, Dorothy Parker, and William Faulkner. Movies include the hottest stars of the 1920s, including Greta Garbo, Rudolph Valentino, and Buster Keaton, and lots of music. Over 400,000 recordings entered the public domain. If anyone creates something that and copyrights it this year, remember it enters the public domain under current law in 2118. Put it on your calendar. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW professor talks about her new book of poems inspired by and written during MRI scans and other hospital visits. Now it's a brand new year and a popular time to set personal goals for the weeks and months ahead. Losing weight and getting in better physical shape are common resolutions. And if somebody just got you a new fitness tracker, well, you're ready to go. But there are some things you need to understand about how those things work. They may not be as helpful as you think they are, and they might not be right for you. Lisa Cadmus-Bertram is an associate professor of kinesiology at UW-Madison. She's also co-leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Her areas of interest include physical activity and sedentary behavior and mobile technologies to promote health. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. It's great to be with you.
What do you see as the optimal use? If somebody has that fitness tracker, what is the best case scenario?
Fitness trackers are really great for people who want to get more awareness about their current physical activity level and those who want to increase their physical activity level, particularly for people who do the most common types of physical activity that, you know, are walking, jogging, cycling, types of activities that activity trackers can pick up well.
Do you see downsides? Do they motivate us in the wrong way sometimes?
Absolutely. So one of the downsides of fitness trackers is that they can exacerbate tendencies that some people have. So if you have had experiences in the past where you have been prone to things like disordered eating behaviors or compulsive exercise, you know, fitness trackers are similar to scales and diet tracking apps and all those other tools in that they can motivate us in really healthy ways. But there are a small proportion of people who might find those types of tools to be something that might trigger unhealthy tendencies. So we all have heard stories of people who can kind of become a little too obsessed with the tracker or letting their success with exercise or with diet tracking on any given day sort of dictate how the rest of their day goes. So certainly if you've had any of those experiences in the past, that might be something to watch out for and, you know, consider whether a fitness tracker, you know, might or might not be the best tool for you.
Let's stay with people in that situation. What might you recommend instead of a fitness tracker so that, you know, they still want to get decent, healthy physical activity, but without that obsessive risk, that addictive risk you were talking about?
Yeah, those are individuals for whom, you know, a more laid back or intuitive approach can tend to be the healthiest. So from a public health perspective, we're used to dealing with the majority of the population are people who can really benefit from more activity, who can really benefit from a deeper understanding of their activity patterns. For the people on the other end of the spectrum, sometimes more data is not necessarily going to be helpful. So these tend to be people who are already very health literate, already pretty vigilant about those types of behaviors. So then really just focusing on less data gathering, less monitoring can be really helpful, and really getting people to dial in and think about what types of activity they enjoy and really bring them, you know, peace, you know, might be getting back into nature, but really kind of focusing on some of those more emotional aspects of activity rather than the numbers can be beneficial.
Now, I'm in that bigger group, I think, that you mentioned, Lisa. Sedentary job, many of my recreational activities involve sitting or standing in one place. I have found a fitness tracker makes me get up and walk around, go out for a walk more. How can somebody, the lazy person in my situation, make the best use of that fitness tracker?
Absolutely. So we recommend that people just wear the tracker for about a week to get a baseline sense of how active they are. A lot of times we're all so busy that we might feel really tired at the end of the day, and we kind of think, oh, I'm a super active person, I'm always on the go. But being really busy doesn't necessarily translate to getting the exercise that we really need to get in order to feel our best. So kind of getting that initial assessment is a really important first step, and then setting some goals. And we encourage people to, you know, try to avoid the trap of getting distracted by all the different types of goals that you can set and really focus on one thing. So maybe just focusing on steps or just focusing on accumulating, you know, minutes of physical activity per week, and to set goals over the short period of time. So January is a time when people tend to set long-term vague goals, like I will exercise more this year. When really a more helpful goal is to set a goal like I will walk for 20 minutes after dinner, Monday through Friday of this week. So setting goals that are very specific and over a short time frame.
As we wrap up, Lisa, with or without a fitness tracker, it seems like the key here is motivation to keep going with exercise. Can you leave us with some encouragement to motivate us to keep doing something?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, oftentimes when we talk about exercise, we talk about long-term benefits, like reducing your risk of cardiovascular disease or cancer or diabetes, when often the way our brains work is that often we're more motivated by the short term. So sometimes we encourage people who are looking for that motivation to really focus in on the benefits that you're going to get right away, that it's going to help you let go of your work stress. It's going to help you feel more energetic, more relaxed, and kind of focus on those immediate benefits that you can get from getting up and getting out there.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lisa Cadmus-Bertram is an associate professor of kinesiology at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about the pros and cons of fitness trackers. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy to tell us a story about a family of blacksmiths.
Wisconsin, four generations of blacksmiths work together creating art they hope will last for hundreds of years. The metal sculptures created by Boleslav Kohanovsky and his sons grace public spaces in Stevens Point, Door County, and beyond. Rob Menser has more.
When Boleslav Kohanovsky works in his blacksmith shop in rural Portage County, he thinks about his father. His dad was a blacksmith who apprenticed in Boleslav's great uncle's shop in Zamość, Poland. When World War II came, he was rounded up by the Nazis and forced to work for the regime. But after the war, he and his wife came to Chicago. He got a job forging parts for train cars for the Chicago Transit Authority. Some of Boleslav's earliest memories of his dad are connected to that work.
I knew he worked with metal, and he smelled, the smells of metal were on his clothes, and I remember those smells. Smells a very strong sense, and I remember that as a very young boy of three or four, I suppose, and that was inspirational to me.
Boleslav became a blacksmith too. He started out doing structural steel, forging the bones of buildings. He loved drafting and working with metal, but he wanted to do artistic work.
The structural steel was basically anonymous work, and I wanted to do work that was not anonymous.
So Boleslav started to create decorative metal railings. He practiced expressing himself through the metal he forged. That was 40 years ago. Today, he works with three of his sons on metal sculptures and other art pieces.
This is the blacksmith shop. That's the forge over there.
The coals in the forge heat the ends of the iron red hot until it's malleable. For some tasks, they use a massive power hammer to flatten it. Other things, they hand forge with a hammer and an anvil.
Forging is where the art happens. If you can't interpret it at the forge, it's nothing.
One of Boleslav's sculptures, an 18-foot spire with a flying crane, looks out over Egg Harbor. This summer, the city of Stevens Point unveiled his sculpture of the word point in the roundabout entering town. Even a smaller project like a railing can take weeks to complete, so the shop always has multiple projects in the works. In the next room, Boleslav's youngest son, Valerius, is drawing sunflower leaves onto a steel sheet.
We're gonna cut it out like this with like a plasma torch. And then I'm gonna put it in the forge, and then we're gonna shape it, put grooves in it, put it to life. Yep.
Valerius's older brother, August, says they want to use the unique qualities of the metal they work with.
So say, for instance, I'm splitting a bar of metal, right? It's naturally going to swell on the sides, right? I'm going to let that show. Or if I'm drawing out a piece of metal, I'll leave the hammer blows. And the iron just becomes a vehicle to express our ideas through.
Boleslav is deeply connected to his Polish roots. On the afternoon that he was showing me around his shop, a surprise visitor named Peter Semeniak dropped by from Chicago.
Yeah, I am vice consul in Polish consulate.
He was visiting in part because of the project Boleslav was working on that day. It's a piece meant to symbolize the friendship and connection between Poland and the United States. On two tall spires, two eagles are perched, a Polish white eagle and an American bald eagle. Boleslav still feels a connection to his great uncle's blacksmith shop in southeastern Poland, and he takes pride in the fact that his work will last.
When I was young, I couldn't believe it that cars, you know, rusted out like they do in that planned obsolescence thing. I really liked that locomotives were made and designed to go a million miles because they were built right. I really have the attitude that my work is time transcending, that it'll be around a very long time.
Don't WPR's Rob Menser brought us that story on the art of metalworking. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a Wisconsin poet joins the show with haiku she composed while inside MRI machines, at infusion centers, and in medical waiting rooms. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You may remember learning about, maybe even writing, haiku back in school. The poems, inspired by a Japanese tradition, look short and simple, but they can pack a lot of punch. Our next guest turned to haiku to deal with and to share her experiences with long-term illness and disability, starting with poems composed in MRI machines, infusion centers, and waiting rooms. Ellen Samuels is professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison, author of Fantasies of Identification, Disability, Gender, Race. Her critical work has appeared in a number of journals and anthologies, including Signs, Journal of Women in Culture and Society, and Feminist Disability Studies. Ellen's latest book is a collection of haiku called Hypermobilities. Ellen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, your book dives right into haiku, and I was hoping you could share some of the first section with us called Hypermobility.
Yes. So there's seven poems in each section, seven haiku, so I'll just read them from this first section. The first poem is called Hypermobility. No one is supposed to bend that far. No one knows why you don't just break. Baton hypermobility scale, thumb, wrist, palm on floor, all the ways you go too far, tally up your score. The difference between joint subluxation and dislocation. Door unlatched in the body house, shutter to slow kiss the jam or slam. Hypermobility of the small joints, to press a button means fingers, muscle, past bone. Yes, no, enter, yes. Hypermobility of the large joints. If your legs were wings, they need to swing this far out, and feathers, and sky. Hypermobility of the large joints too. Don't climb a hill, then pick up leaves. Too much bending, I mean ambition. Hypermobility of the large joints three. The ankle joint is connected to the leg joint. That's enough for now.
Now, before we talk more about the poetry and how you wrote it, can you tell us a little bit about this chronic condition, hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, if I'm pronouncing that all correctly?
Yeah, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is named after the two doctors who first described it. So one doctor's last name was Ehlers and one was Danlos. It is an inherited collagen defect. Collagen is one of the building blocks of our bodies. So this collagen defect affects all the systems of the body in a variety of ways. But the most hallmark way, and often the most visible way, is that it causes what they call hypermobility in joints. The ligaments that are supposed to hold your joints in place are weakened by this disorder. And so joints can slip out of place, can, as they say, medically subluxate, which is like a partial dislocation, or dislocate just from the tiniest movement. I can dislocate my shoulder just, you know, turning over in bed. And Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is considered a rare disorder, but in recent years, it's being diagnosed much, much more often, and it's beginning to be thought it was more of an underdiagnosed but more common syndrome, rather than being as rare as was once thought.
You've been living with this for a long time, pre and post diagnosis, lots of treatment. What started you coming up with these haiku about it?
Yeah, it started in 2014 when I was diagnosed with a complication of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which was a dissection in one of the arteries going to my brain. I spent a lot of time in MRI machines, getting head and neck MRIs. And that's quite an intense experience in any case, but in my case, they were often, It was in a very emergency setting, which was more stressful. And it's very loud. In the MRI machines, they give you little headphones with music, but you can't really hear the music because the machine is so loud. And I needed something to kind of hold on to get through these hours in the machines. And so I started to write haiku in my head because it was such a short form that I could write it in my head without, you know, being able to write on any form of writing implement. And I started doing that as well when I was getting other treatments, spending time in the infusion centers at the hospital with different drugs. And it just really helped center me and give me a sense of control when things felt very out of control. And that's why I really hewed very strictly to the 5-7-5 syllabus form, which isn't even, I think, by haiku experts considered quote unquote real haiku at this point. But for me, it was really essential to the experience.
When did this go, Ellen, from basically a coping mechanism to something you realized you wanted to share with the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. At a certain point, I started writing them down in a document on my computer and occasionally posting one on social media. And I think when I had about 20 or 25 haiku was when I started to think maybe these are more than a coping mechanism. Maybe I'm actually writing a book and it's kind of a memoir in haiku about this experience. I have an MFA in creative writing from Cornell University. I've wrote and published poetry a lot early in my career, but more recently I had not written and published poetry in a long time. And so it was probably, you know, after a couple of years of doing this that I started to turn it into a book. And then it was just published this year, which I'm really excited about.
Talking to Ellen Samuels, professor at UW-Madison, author of the new book we're talking about, a collection of poems, haiku, called Hypermobilities. I want to talk about this for a couple different audiences, Ellen. First of all, for people with disabilities, what are you hoping that they take out of your, as you say, your memoir in haiku form?
I'm glad you asked that because, I mean, the disability community is the community that has sustained me through my experience, both before and after diagnosis, as a person with significant physical disabilities. And so for my community, I hope to say, first and foremost, always, you're not alone. It's tremendously isolating to have any kind of disability, to have any kind of chronic illness. You often feel very cut off from the world. And so I see all my writing as different ways to connect with that community and say, you're not alone. Here's my experience. Is my experience useful to you? Just as so many others, writers' experiences have been so profoundly useful for me.
And then for people not dealing with a chronic illness or a disability, or at least not yet, I guess, Ellen, one line that stuck out in your afterword to the book, quoting, "I don't want to be pitied, but I also don't want to pretend everything is okay." That struck me. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's really the bind that you're in with any kind of chronic illness, I think, is that how do you answer the question, how are you? Beyond if you just you give the automatic okay, right? If you tell the truth, then the automatic reaction is some kind of pity or otherwise putting you, you know, assigning you to a category of someone who is damaged in some way and that healthy people want to distinguish themselves from, right? We literally have, you know, expressions like there, but for the grace of God, go I, or like, you know, well, if I see that Ellen with everything she's dealing with, you know, can do this, then I shouldn't complain. That seems like an uplifting sentiment at first, but it's actually a profoundly dehumanizing one in a way, because it suggests that we are not the same kind of people. And I just have to observe that I think this is true at all times. It was true when I wrote the book pre the COVID-19 pandemic, but certainly during the pandemic, it's becoming clear that we are all vulnerable. We are all physically, mentally, and emotionally interdependent, linked, and vulnerable people who cannot divide ourselves into the worlds of so easily of who's healthy and who is not.
in our last minute or so, Ellen, for getting back to others in the disability community now, would you encourage them to join you and I think a growing number of people with disabilities who are expressing themselves in poetry, in prose, in whatever form?
I do. I do encourage everyone to write or create in the way that works for you. There are, of course, Instagram poets. That's not something I could ever do, but I think if that works for people and it reaches people, it's great. I've had the great privilege of teaching writing in a variety of settings for the last few decades. And one of the most amazing things is to see someone who says, I've never even thought to write a poem in my life. What is a poem? And then by the end of the semester have discovered in themselves this rich, beautiful, poetic voice they didn't know was there. I think writing is a gift, but it's also a skill that can be learned and that everyone can do it.
It's a great place to leave it. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of your poetry.
Thanks for having me.
Ellen Samuels is a professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about her new book of haiku poetry. It's called Hypermobilities. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, how has fatherhood changed during the pandemic? We'll hear from a Milwaukee fatherhood project, and you can share your stories too. Health writer Julie Rovner is back with us for a look at what options are on the table for the federal and state governments in dealing with the latest COVID news. And music can be good for us at any time of our lives, can really help us through the process of aging. We'll learn more from the authors of the new book, Music, Wellness, and Aging. That's tomorrow on Central Time.